FM, KPFT, Houston. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
Just like to start off with some voter information. A question sort of came up, when I say came up since there are no callers, it popped into my head and out of my mouth, about how much postage a ballot needs. My wife and I each put on 2 first-class stamps, but that was just because we wanted to be absolutely sure. Not everybody maybe has that many stamps or wants to spend that money. Mm-hmm. So I actually called the Harris County Clerk's office, spoke to someone there. This is how they broke it down for me. Including the 2 envelopes, if you have a ballot that is either 1 page or 2 page, you can probably use 1 first class stamp. If you have 3 to 4 pages of ballot, you need 2 stamps. If you have 5 to 6 pages of ballots, you need 3 stamps. Now, I mean, I can qualify this by saying the first ounce is so much and then the second and third ounce are so much. But let's just say 3 first-class stamps, 2 stamps, or 1 stamp, depending on whether it's up to 2 pages, up to 4 pages, or up to 6 pages. And this depends on where you are in the county. It probably is true anywhere in Texas because they're using the same envelopes, basically. I say basically. And probably the same ballot paper, probably. And this may also be more or less true elsewhere around the country where they use the 2 envelopes and similar size weight ballots. But this is guidance. It's not authoritative. When in doubt, call your county clerk. Just saying. Okay, early voting has started. There are about a dozen drive-through places to vote. There are 120 early voting locations. It is still not too late, theoretically. It's not too late to apply for a mail-in ballot if you qualify, but your application must be received by October 23rd. It's not a matter of postmark. It has to be received. So if you haven't applied for it, if you don't absolutely need it, maybe your next safest choice is to go to one of the drive-through ballot sites.
Yeah.
I think that Harris may be the only county in Texas doing that, and it was one of those things permitted by the Secretary of State, because you're allowed to request a curbside ballot, and I don't think they anticipated a county clerk actually saying, great, we'll just do a drive-through voting site. Hmm. And that's apparently how that happened. Okay. We actually have what may be a fairly full show.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we have one that we're going to kind of focus on at the end. It's going to be whenever we get to it, to whenever the show ends, it's going to be probably that topic. Okay, first of all, as far as county drop-off locations for voting, a federal appeals court did rule that Governor Abbott's order dropping off mail-in ballots is limited to 1 per county, but apparently that order did not take effect because it's being appealed. So at least in Harris, you're still only down to NRG Stadium. That's still in contention. Mm. Drive-through voting locations in Harris County see greater numbers than in-person in spite of challenges. Over 42,000 residents, this is from communityimpact.com, by the way, over 42,000 residents in Harris County voted drive-through in the first 4 days of early voting from the 13th to 16th. County Clerk Chris Holland said, my number one priority is to keep voters and poll workers safe. The feedback we received from the drive-through voting pilot proves that voters felt safe exercising their right to vote and that it was an easy and efficient alternative to going inside a voting center. I want to add for someone like me, where the choice is to bring a walker or a wheelchair or a folding chair where I have to stand in line and I really can't stand for more than a few minutes at a time comfortably, sitting in a car for 3 hours is preferable to standing in a line for an hour. That's kind of how I feel. There's also, at harrisvotes.com, there's also a video detailing how voters can use the drive-through system. The Texas Republican Party filed a last-minute lawsuit against, and by the way, there's a link to this. Everything, thinkwingradio.com, links to the stories and also a link to the video. The Texas Republican Party filed a last-minute lawsuit against Holland's county clerk's office on October 12th to restrict drive-through and curbside voting to, quote, only those Harris County registered voters who have submitted sworn applications. That's according to the Texas Secretary of State's office, where they say that curbside voting is allowed upon request to an election officer. So apparently they've just, the county here has just said, hey, if you drive up, you're requesting it. The lawsuit was dismissed October 13th, which is to say the Republican Party's lawsuit of Texas. And since then, many of the drive-through sites have seen more drive-through voters than regular voters. Luke Twombly, I think that's pronouncing it correctly, press secretary for the Texas Republican Party, said the party is taking the case to the Texas Supreme Court. Quote, we filed this case to ensure that no illegal votes would be cast and counted in this election. As an aside, I say, oh, sure, that's the reason. Okay. From NPR.org, women's marches being held in Washington, D.C. and cities nationwide. Women's marches are underway Saturday. This is from the 17th. So we're pre-recording this on Sunday morning at a ridiculous hour of after 7 a.m. And so these marches would have been yesterday, except for you guys, it was 2 days ago. But anyway. The latest iteration of the protest event, first held the day after Trump's 2017 inauguration, came as the Senate is moving toward a confirmation vote on the president's third Supreme Court nominee. Saturday's tentpole event in Washington, which is to say the women's protest was permitted for 10,000 attendees, organizers said that in total some 380 events were planned throughout the country. Well, come Monday afternoon, if you look it up, you'll actually know, because you'll be able to look it up. Mm. TheEconomist.com had a story from October 8th. The pandemic has caused the world's economies to diverge. This is actually kind of interesting. In February, the coronavirus pandemic struck the world economy with the biggest shock since the Second World War. The crash was synchronized. As the recovery takes place, however, the huge gaps between the performance of countries are opening up, which could yet recast the world's economic order. By the end of next year, according to forecasts, America's economy will be the same size as it was in 2019, but China's will be 10% larger. Actually, Andrew and I were kind of discussing this before we started recording.
Yeah.
According to the last statistics we could find, that Andrew could find, to be honest, the United States GDP was something like $20 trillion.
Yeah.
China's, this was like as of, they're estimating as of October of this year.
Yeah.
And China's GDP was something like $15 trillion U.S. dollars equivalent.
Yeah.
So assuming that that number is anywhere in the ballpark, and let's say that it may not be as accurate as we might like, I think it's important to understand that when you talk about GDP versus per capita income, that because the United States has 25% the population of China, that GDP goes a lot further, at least in theory, per capita.
Yeah, theoretically at least.
Theoretically. But in China, assuming they ever get to the point where their GDP exceeds the United States, that's a national resource that they can put toward diplomacy, military development, or war.
Right.
So total national resources in that way count more than per capita income.
Yeah.
Although there may be a point below which you cannot allow your per capita income to drop, even in wartime. Otherwise, what you end up doing is, you know, starving your population to death.
Hmm.
So there are minimums, but national resource, national GDP at the end of the day, I think, is more important in terms of national global influence and national defense or offense for that matter.
Yeah.
Going on, Europe will probably languish beneath its pre-pandemic level of output and could do so for several years. This is China being 10% larger, America being at 2019 levels. Europe probably still struggling, and Japan perhaps as well, because Japan also has a demographic issue in terms of an older, aging population, fewer young workers. And it's not just the biggest economic blocks that are growing at different speeds. And the distribution of growth rates across 50 economies, that distribution was at its widest for at least 40 years. The U.S. has injected more stimulus than Europe, including spending about 12% of GDP and a 1.5 percentage point cut in short-term interest rates. Hey, have you looked at your bank interest lately? But policy also includes how governments respond to structural changes and the creative destruction the pandemic is causing. In the publication, The Economist Special Report, they explained that these adjustments will be immense. The pandemic will leave economies less globalized, more digitized, and less equal. As they cut risks in their supply chains and harness automation, manufacturers will bring production closer to home. As office workers continue to work in their kitchens and bedrooms for at least part of the week, lower paid workers who previously toiled as waiters, cleaners, and sales assistants will need to find new jobs, maybe in the suburbs. Until they do, they could face long spells of unemployment. In America, permanent job losses are mounting even as the headline unemployment rate falls. I want to emphasize, as usual, that we heavily excerpt most of these articles. So while we try to avoid bias in the excerpts, I do always suggest going to the blog post for the show at thinkingradio.com. I have links to all the articles I cite, and you can read the articles for yourself. In some cases, I'll actually recommend reading the article as opposed to just going by my excerpts. Let's do a quick break. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. You can help support KPFT, help keep us on the air for another 50 years by going to kpft.org and clicking on donate, by calling 713-526-5738, and that's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, up until the 31st of October, 713-526-5738. You can also text to that number, 713-526-5738, and text the word give, and you'll get through an automated process. You can pick the show you want to support. You can decide how much you would like to contribute, etc. So, Andrew, do you want to talk a little about why you might want to continue to support KPFT?
Absolutely. I mean, community radio is, I mean, it's a great thing. Obviously, you think that or you wouldn't be listening. If you're not convinced, hopefully we can convince you. It's important, though, because it's important for, you know, the media in a town or a city, a community of any size, to not just be controlled by for-profit interests, you know, big corporations or small businesses even, honestly. Nonprofit broadcasting is important because it means that there is a voice in, you know, on the airwaves that is able to talk about things that aren't necessarily, you know, directly in its interest. That
Pacific is an independent network in an age of media concentration when exactly half of the Houston radio stations are owned by about five companies.
Exactly. And, you know, that means that we don't have to please investors. We don't have to please sponsors. All we have to do
is please you.
Exactly. We just have to
please. And sometimes not even that, depending on the show you're listening to.
Yeah, sometimes.
Well, I mean, to, you know, don't quote, but, you know, tell anyone I said that.
Well, we'll just tell them it was a self-deprecating joke. It'll be fine.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah. So, you know, that's why we appreciate, you know, any amount of money that you can give, from, you know, 1 cent to, you know, $100 or
even
$1,000.
Okay, well, let's start with a buck.
Yeah.
At least a buck.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want to be greedy, but, you know, it costs too much to process a one penny donation.
Yeah, that's true.
So let's just start with a buck, and then you can go up from there. As much as you want. This is actually kind of interesting. Well, of course, everything that I do is potentially interesting. Otherwise, I would just overlook it. The EU, according to NPR.org, the EU is sanctioning Russian officials over the Navalny poisoning, citing chemical weapons use. The European Union is hitting six high-placed Russian officials with sanctions over the suspected assassination attempt of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, citing the use of forbidden chemical weapons. Lab tests found Navalny was poisoned by a variant of Novichok, a rare Soviet-era nerve agent. Actually, rare isn't the word to use there. It's a nerve agent that's only available to government agents. It's just not the kind of thing you find on the market. This is a quote, "The use of chemical weapons constitutes a serious breach of international law," according to the European Council on Thursday as it published the sanctions in the EU's official journal. The council had previously condemned the poisoning of Navalny, who spent weeks receiving treatment in Germany after an emergency evacuation from Russia in late August. A state entity in Moscow also is on the sanctions list. The EU said it included the State Scientific Research Institute for Organic Chemistry and Technology because it is responsible for, quote, "the destruction of chemical weapon stocks inherited from the Soviet Union." In other words, you should have not had these. Anyway.
I looked it up, and apparently this poisoning happened back in August of this year. Yes. I thought it had happened, like, farther back than that.
Oh, yes, because this isn't the first time they've tried to poison him, allegedly.
Oh. Yeah,
This is either the second or the third time, and that does not include the time that a long-lasting dye was thrown in his face and potentially could have blinded him.
Yeah, I guess.
And there's a video of him basically with his face and eyes green.
I guess I was thinking that, you know, with COVID stuff going on, you know, time seems a lot longer than it actually has been.
No, it's not COVID. It's Trump. It's Trump time.
It's both of them.
Yeah. But, okay.
Yeah. I could have sworn that it had happened like 2018 or something, but
yeah. Last time.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, this is either the second or third, it's at least the second, perhaps the third time that he has allegedly, potentially been poisoned to kill him.
Mm.
Okay, this is, I think, the key story we're going to talk about. It's a New York Times article, a lengthy one. We have excerpted it and re-excerpted it to try to fit it into the time we have. We'll see how that goes. It's called "The First Amendment in the Age of Disinformation" from October 13th. And again, heavily excerpted, trying not to include any biases from us and trying to keep our story focused in a way that the article is a little broader. So we're trying to be a little narrower. It starts off, "The U.S. is in the midst of an information crisis caused by the spread of viral disinformation, which is defined as falsehoods aimed at achieving a political goal. Misinformation refers more generally to falsehoods." So this is an important distinction, disinformation versus misinformation. A lot of people use the terms interchangeably. They should not. "Republicans have promoted a false narrative of widespread voter fraud. A.G. William Barr said on CNN in September that someone in Texas was indicted for filling out 1,700 ballots for other people. This never happened. Links from Fox News hosts and other right-wing figures aligned with Trump often dominate the top links in Facebook's news feed for likes, comments, and shares in the U.S. Censorship of external critics by the government remains a serious threat under authoritarian regimes, but in the U.S. and other democracies, there is a different kind of threat, which may be doing more damage to the discourse about politics, news, and science. It encompasses the mass distortion of truth and overwhelming waves of speech from extremists that smear and distract. Along with disinformation campaigns, there is the separate problem of troll armies, a flood of commenters often propelled by bots that aim to discredit or to destroy the reputation of disfavored speakers and to discourage them from speaking again, as stated by Jack Goldsmith, a conservative law professor at Harvard, and he writes in an essay that was published this year. Tim Wu, a progressive law professor at Columbia, points out in the same book, "The use of speech as a tool to suppress speech is, by its nature, something very challenging for the First Amendment to deal with. These and other scholars argue something that may seem unsettling to Americans. that perhaps our way of thinking about free speech is not the best way. At the very least, we should understand that it isn't the only way. Other democracies in Europe and elsewhere have taken a different approach. Facts and transparency are the intended pillars of the modern First Amendment. Since the nation's founding, the Constitution has guaranteed that the government, quote, shall make no law, unquote, abridging, quote, the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people to peaceably assemble. In the 1960s, Supreme Court majorities laid the cornerstones of modern American free speech protections when the justices struck down an Ohio law used to arrest a Ku Klux Klan leader for speaking at a rally. This decision barred the government from punishing speech unless it encouraged and was likely to cause, quote, imminent lawless action, unquote. In another case, the court made it difficult for a public figure to sue a newspaper for libel that included false statements. Errors, the court said, were inevitable in free debate and must be protected. It's a fundamentally optimistic vision that good ideas win. The better argument will be persuasive. As an aside, I often like to quote actually an episode of Star Trek, The Omega Glory, where Dr. McCoy says, Spock, I found that evil usually triumphs unless good is very, very careful. Same basic premise. That, needless to say, was not in the article. There is a counter-tradition, however. It's alert to the ways in which demagogic leaders or movements can use propaganda, an older term that can be synonymous with disinformation. Andrew and I were discussing that actually it's from the word propagate, which is to spread information, but it's taken on the darker meaning of basically false information, disinformation. A crude authoritarian censors free speech. A clever one invokes it to play a trick, twisting facts to turn a mob on a subordinated group and, in the end, silence as well as endanger its members. In other words, good ideas do not necessarily triumph in the marketplace of ideas. Also, as an aside, I think that there's also a saying to the effect that to tell a total lie is not as persuasive as telling the truth with lies mixed in. It makes it harder to tell the difference. Essentially, where's the lie, where's the truth? In 2012, by a 6-3 vote, the court provided some constitutional protection for an individual's intentional lies, at least as long as they don't cause serious harm. So somewhere along the way, the conservative majority has lost sight of an essential point. The purpose of free speech is to further democratic participation, says Yale Law professor Robert Post. The crucial function of protecting speech is to give persons the sense that the government is theirs, which we might call democratic legitimation. In a 2018 book, Network Propaganda, the three authors found that the conservative media did not counter lies and distortions, but rather recycled them from one outlet to the next on TV and radio and through like-minded websites. The dearth of competition for factual accuracy among conservative outlets leaves their audiences vulnerable to disinformation, even if the mainstream news media combats it. People are more likely to believe fact-checking from a source that speaks against its apparent political interest, research shows. In the eyes of many conservatives, news outlets like the Washington Post, New York Times, and CNN do not fill that role when they challenge a story that Trump and Fox News promote. It's kind of like, and I'm saying this as an aside, it's kind of like when I am offered a free service. Sometimes I will actually ask, okay, I like the fact that it's free. How are you making money? Because at some point, they can't do it for free. They have to make money somewhere. So essentially, this is the same theory, that if the media rebutting a piece of information, alleged information, isn't disadvantaged by that rebuttal, can you trust that rebuttal? Is that understandable? Andrew?
Yeah, I think it is.
Okay. Makes sense?
Yeah.
The way I,
okay. Yeah. It also strikes me that this is kind of touching on the same point as a story that we mentioned like last episode or maybe an episode before, talking about the lies are paywalled, but the truth is free from Current yes. Affairs. These conservative outlets that don't really, you know, bother with factual accuracy. Many times, they make sure that their content is freely accessible. They make sure that it's widespread, and, you know, making it free is part of that. And the outlets that actually do have to fact check things, you know, though they have to make money in order to be able to keep that, like, quality of content up, the fact that they often directly charge their readers for it means that, you know, fewer people could see it. So.
It actually raises an interesting question, which is that the media like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CNN, they are not nonprofit organizations. They are profit-making organizations, and they survive by getting subscribers and advertisers.
Right.
So their paywall, defensively, is a way of protecting the copyrighted material that they have to pay and work to generate, mm-hmm. and at some point they have to be paid for. They have to be compensated. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to think that the right-wing media, like The Blaze, like Fox News, like Breitbart, theoretically, they're not nonprofit organizations either, and yet they offer their news for free. So the question is, what's the business model there? And maybe we should put business in parentheses or in quotation marks. Maybe it's more a propaganda model. Just a thought. Let's do a quick station break. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson. You can go to the articles that we discuss on this show by going to my website at thinkwingradio.com. I always post, and usually the day of the show, sometimes it's a little delayed, but usually not. Thinkwingradio.com, there's usually a blog post for the show, and I have those going back to actually 2010, if you wanted to go back that far. And you can link to the articles, and even though we excerpt them, you can read the articles in full and come to your own conclusions and decide if I or we did a fair job in our editorial choices.
Actually,
as we discussed earlier, what we're doing is taking an article that an editor has already gone through and excerpting it, and then sometimes re-editing the excerpting, in this case, to condense it further.
Yeah.
So that's a process.
Yeah, I mean, especially for this article, like, I really recommend you go to the blog post at thinkwingradio.com and click through and read this full article. It's pretty long, but, you know, it makes a lot more points, and it goes into a lot more detail than I think we can really go into here.
We really had to focus on one narrow aspect of the story, whereas the story itself actually is rather broader with rather more information supporting its statements and conclusions. And of course, you will have to use one of your free articles on the New York Times if you don't subscribe, but I think it's well worth it.
Yeah.
And actually, we're halfway through the month, so maybe it's time to use one of those free articles. Also, we are in the middle of our fall fun drive. I like to call it fun drive, take out one of the D's. And you can help keep this show and this station on the air by going to kpft.org any time of the day or night, clicking on the donate link, and deciding what show you would like to support and how much you would like to contribute to the station. No matter how little, medium, or large the contribution, they're all greatly appreciated, because some people can afford more than others. Also, you can call 713-526-5738, and for the duration of the fun drive through the end of this month, there will be someone at that number 24/7, and they will help you through the process. And if you want to get a thank you gift, they'll help you decide at your contribution level what thank you gifts you might qualify for. I believe that a membership is at least a $25 contribution at least once a year. There is no required level for you to contribute. It's just as much as maybe you feel you can afford at a given time.
You can also, you know, follow Mike on Twitter at Thinkwing Radio, and you can follow me on Twitter at DominateEYE. And we post, you know, political things. If you like our discussions here, if you like the kind of content we provide here, you can find more of that there.
Also, just because I keep thinking I hear my cat who is outside, I will mention that I have another site called Audrey the Cat on Twitter. So, you know, if you like cat stuff, I do retweet cat stuff. That's my fun, non-political Twitter account. But
And if you happen to miss one of our spectacular episodes of Think Wing Radio, you can find them up until, I believe, 30 days for our show.
I think for our show it's 60.
Okay, well, even better. On the archive at archive.kpft.org. You can find most of ThinkWing, KPFT's excellent programming there as well, in case there's any other shows you like and want to keep up with.
And now that you remind me, you can also podcast this show and many other shows from KPFT. So you don't have to catch it at 3 p.m. You don't have to go to archive.kpft.org. You can just go to your podcast app and just continually download these shows and listen to them at your convenience.
Yep.
So there's that. Okay, getting back to our article, which is, let me scroll back here metaphorically, the First Amendment in the Age of Disinformation. In the past, ensuring a vibrant free press made up of competing outlets was an express aim of federal policy. From the founding until the early 20th century, Congress lowered the cost of starting and running a newspaper or magazine by setting low postage rate for mailed copies. The advent of radio raised questions about how to foster competition and public access. According to the article, lawmakers of both parties recognize the danger that an information chokehold poses to democratic self-government, says Ellen P. Goodman, a law professor at Rutgers University. So, she says, policymakers adopted structures to ensure diversity of ownership, local control of media, and public broadcasting. In 1927, when Congress created the licensing system for exclusive rights to the broadcast spectrum so that radio broadcasters could secure a place on the dial, lawmakers told broadcasters to act, quote, as if people of a community should own a station. The 1934 Communications Act similarly required anyone with a broadcast license to operate, to operate in the public interest and allocated spectrum based on ensuring that local communities had their own stations. In 1949, the Federal Communications Commission established the Fairness Doctrine, which interpreted operating in the public interest to require broadcasters to cover major public policy debates and present multiple points of view. And in 1967, Congress created and funded the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, whose mission is to, quote, promote an educated and informed civil society, unquote, and reserve broadcast spectrum for local NPR and PBS stations. During these decades, broadcasters were held to a standard of public trusteeship, in which the right to use the airwaves came with a mandate to provide for democratic discourse. I remember those days. Broadcasters made money and lots of it, but profit wasn't their only reason for existing. According to Matthew Genskow, an economist at Stanford who studies trust in information, the networks had a public service obligation, and when they went to get their licenses renewed, the news divisions fulfilled that. The model coincided with a rare period in American history of relatively high levels of trust in media and low levels of political polarization. But public trusteeship for broadcast and diverse ownership began to unravel with the libertarian shift of the Reagan era. In the mid-1980s, the administration waived the FCC. Now, this is under the Reagan administration. They waived the FCC rule that barred a single entity from owning a TV station and a daily newspaper in the same local market to allow Rupert Murdoch to continue to own the New York Post and the Boston Herald after he bought his first broadcast TV stations in New York and Boston. By the way, this became known as the Murdoch exception. It's what we live with today. It basically paved the way for the kind of media concentration we have now. The FCC repealed the Fairness Doctrine, which had required broadcasters to include multiple points of view, in 1987. When that went, that was the beginning of the complete triumph in media of the libertarian view of the First Amendment, Rutgers law professor Goodman says. Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes, Ailes being a former Nixon campaign advisor, started Fox News as the first TV network to cultivate a conservative audience in 1996. A decade later, studies showed what has become known as the Fox News effect. After a local cable system adds Fox News to the lineup, voters in the vicinity tend to shift toward Republican candidates. As Trump's ally and frequent platform, Fox News can help shift its audience's behavior towards his views even when they may risk public health. In a study this year, a team of economists controlling for other factors found that communities with higher numbers of Fox News viewers were less likely to comply with stay-at-home orders to fight coronavirus. In the early 90s, David D. Smith, a conservative who inherited the Sinclair Broadcast Group from his father, bought a second local TV station in Pittsburgh, despite a federal regulation barring the ownership of more than one station in a local market. In Baltimore, Sinclair got around the same rule by creating another company, Glencairn, controlled by Smith's mother and an employee. Sinclair is growing as local journalism is hollowing out. About 1,800 metro and community newspapers have closed or merged since 2004, and Sinclair is now the largest station owner in swing states. "We are here to deliver your message, period," Smith reportedly told Trump during the 2016 campaign. In early 2018, dozens of Sinclair newscasters across the country echoed Trump's diatribes against the press by reading from the same script warning of, quote, fake stories, unquote, from some members of the media. Deadspin.com, or Deadspin magazine, captured the repetition of the script in an eerie video montage. There's a link on my website and in the story to that montage. It is truly eerie. In July, Sinclair released online an interview with Judy Mikovits, I think is how it's pronounced, a conspiracy theorist who has accused Dr. Anthony Fauci of manufacturing the coronavirus. When the segment drew criticism, the company canceled the planned on-air broadcast but called itself, quote, a supporter of free speech and a marketplace of ideas and viewpoints, even if incredibly controversial, unquote. In many ways, social media sites today function as the public square. But legally speaking, internet platforms can restrict free speech far more than the government can. As an aside, many people, maybe most people, misunderstand the First Amendment. As we discussed much earlier in this story, the First Amendment simply says that government cannot censor speech. It doesn't say that corporations can't. It doesn't say that newspapers can't. It doesn't say that shopping malls can't. Just the government. So, legally speaking, internet platforms can restrict free speech far more than a government can. They're like, as I was saying, it says in the article, they're like malls where private owners police conduct. Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter have guidelines that moderate content that could drive away users, including spam and pornography, and also certain forms of harassment, hate speech, fake engagement or misrepresentation, and violent extremism. But for years, the companies enforced these rules subjectively and unevenly, allowing for explosions of anti-Semitic memes and targeted harassment of women, for example. Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook and Jack Dorsey of Twitter have each said their sites cannot be, quote, arbiters of truth, unquote, and make important exceptions to their guidelines. Facebook leaves up content including hate speech that breaks the rules when it decides it's newsworthy because it's a post from a politician or a public figure. Says Zuckerberg, in the same way that news outlets will report what a politician says, we think people should generally be able to see for themselves on our platforms. Social media sites have leaned on the First Amendment principles to keep secret the identities of people who appear to abuse their services. Following the right-wing news coverage of the conspiracy theory about Seth Rich, his brother subpoenaed Twitter in a defamation suit against media companies to uncover the name of the person behind the Twitter account, and it's named, alleging that person sent to Fox News a forged FBI document about Rich's case. Twitter fought back in court, saying that unmasking that user would chill speech by violating what the platform's lawyers called a constitutional right to be anonymous. That's what Twitter's lawyers said. This month, a judge ordered Twitter to reveal information that could unmask the person behind that Twitter account. Over the past 2 months, as Trump attacked mail-in voting and the validity of the November election results, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter said they would impose a few more controls on speech about voting. The platforms expanded or reaffirmed their policies for removing a narrow category of content that misleads people about how to vote. In September, Facebook and YouTube joined Twitter in adding labels to content that a fact check has noted could undermine the results of the election or mislead about the results. Facebook contracts with an independent fact-checking network, which includes both the Associated Press and Check Your Fact, a subsidiary of the right-wing outlet The Daily Caller. Twitter does fact-checking internally. YouTube relies on a network of news organizations, including PolitiFact and The Washington Post Fact Checker. Fact-checking and labeling are First Amendment-friendly responses. They counter false speech with more speech at the initiative of a private company, not at the direction of the government. Today, the research consensus among social scientists is that some fact-checking methods significantly reduce the prevalence of false beliefs. In print or on TV, journalists can use headlines or chyrons to provide context and debunking in real time, though they sometimes fail to do so. Angelo Carusone, I'm guessing at the name pronunciation, president of Media Matters for America, a nonprofit media watchdog group, find the changes useful but frustratingly late. He says, we went from them refusing to touch any of the content, an entire ocean of disinformation on voting, election, and integrity, and dismissal of any efforts to address that, to this. They let it metastasize, and now they start doing the thing they could have done all along. Carusone also points out that independent researchers don't have access to data that would allow them to study key questions about the company's claims of addressing disinformation. How prevalent are disinformation and hate speech on the platforms? Are people who see Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube's information labels less likely to share false and misleading content? Which type of warning has the greatest impact? Coordinated fake accounts posting about the election have also shown up on Twitter. In August, NBC News reported on a series of viral tweets that appeared to be from black men who said they were lifelong Democrats and planned to leave the party. The accounts were fake. One used a stock photo of a black man, and the other used a photo of a Dutch model. Twitter eventually took them down. Okay, let's do our last break. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson. You can listen online at kpft.org in the archive. You can also donate to the station at kpft.org. That's an interesting juxtaposition. I may have to redo that one. You can also contact us, even though we are doing pre-recorded shows and you can't call us for the time being anyway. You can still email us, tweet us, Facebook post us. You can go to thinkwingradio@msn.com for an email. You can tweet at Thinkwing Radio. You can go to Facebook, Thinkwing Radio with Mike Koenig. Yes, there is a theme there. So please let us know your thoughts. Give us your suggestions. Give us your feedback. We can still be in touch with you and hope we can be.
Yeah, you can also get in touch with me. I'm on Twitter at DominateEYE and on Tumblr at DominateEYE.tumblr.com.
Okay. Another reason political ads are controversial online is that campaigns or groups that pay for them don't have to disclose their identities as they're required to do on TV, radio, and print. The First Amendment value of individual autonomy means we should know who is speaking to us and why, says law professor Goodman. But online, neither the Supreme Court nor Congress has stepped in to require disclosure. As social media companies have tried to address the spread of disinformation and other toxic speech, conservatives, including Trump, have hurled a series of accusations at the companies that are showing bias against them. You know, I want to point out here, there is a quote that I have kind of kept in my notes that I haven't used in a while, but I think is appropriate here. This is from an interview that Trump did with Leslie Stahl on May 21st, 2018.
I remember this one.
Yeah. The way it goes is this. Leslie Stahl says that when she's telling the story, at one point, Trump started to attack the press. And I said, you know, that is getting tired. Why are you doing this? You're doing it over and over and over, and it's boring, and it's time to end that. You know, you've won the nomination, and why do you keep hammering at this? And Trump said, quote, you know why I do it? I do it to discredit you all and demean you all so that when you write negative stories about me, no one will believe you. According to Leslie Stahl, he said that. So put that in your head for a minute. I think it's worth remembering that story.
Yeah.
The principle of free speech has a different shape and meaning in Europe. For the European Union, as well as democracies like Canada and New Zealand, free speech is not an absolute right from which all other freedoms flow. The European high courts have allowed states to punish incitements of racial hatred or denial of the Holocaust. Germany and France have laws that are designed to prevent the widespread dissemination of hate speech and election-related disinformation. Much of the recent authoritarian experience in Europe arose out of democracy itself, explains Miguel Poyades Maduro, board chairman of the European Digital Media Observatory. project on online disinformation at the European University Institute. The Nazis and others were originally elected. In Europe, there is historically an understanding that democracy needs to protect itself from anti-democratic ideas. It's because of the different democratic ethos of Europe that Europe has accepted more restrictions on speech. The difference between the political speech traditions of the U.S. and Europe was acutely apparent in the American and French presidential elections of 2016 and 2017. When Russian operatives hacked into the computers of the Democratic National Committee, they gave their stolen trove of DNC emails to WikiLeaks, which released the emails in batches to do maximum damage to Clinton and her party in the months before the election. I will say as an aside, they also mixed in false documents. The news media covered the stolen emails extensively, providing information so the public could weigh it even if a foreign adversary had planted it. The French press responded otherwise to a Russian hack in May 2017. 2 days before a national election, the Russians posted online thousands of emails from, by French is bad, En Marche, the party of Emmanuel Macron, who was running for president. France, like several other democracies, has a blackout law that bars news coverage of a campaign for the 24 hours before an election and on its election day. But the emails were available several hours before the blackout began. They were fair game. Yet the French media did not cover them. Le Monde, a major French newspaper, explained that the hack had, quote, the obvious purpose of undermining the integrity of the ballot, unquote. Marine Le Pen, Macron's far-right opponent, accused the news media of a partisan cover-up, but she had no sympathetic outlet to turn to because there is no equivalent to Fox News or Breitbart in France. America's information process was not inevitable, nor is it insoluble. The government, federal or state, could invest in stopping the decline of local reporting by funding nonprofit journalism. It could create new publicly funded TV or radio. Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act effectively makes internet platforms, unlike other publishers, immune from libel and other civil suits for the content they carry. There are plenty of ideas and bills floating around Washington that seek to improve the online speech environment, like the giant step of using antitrust law to break up big tech companies, or medium-sized steps like banning micro-targeted political ads, requiring disclosure of the ad buyers, making the platforms file reports detailing when they remove content or reduce its spread.
A number of digital rights groups believe that Section 230 is one of the founding blocks of the internet. You know, without it, the growth of online platforms, you know, if they had to be responsible for everything that was put onto their platform, they would be a lot more reluctant to have large numbers of users because
but
that
now we're talking about these companies in terms of media concentration.
That's true.
Perhaps being broken up because they're monopolies or oligopolies.
Right. And honestly, I'm not opposed to the idea of breaking up these big tech companies they basically are monopolies, I think, in this day and
age. To fend off regulation and antitrust enforcement, the internet platforms spend millions of dollars on lobbying in Washington. They align their self-interest with a nationalist pitch. Europe, however, doesn't have a stake in the dominance of American tech companies. Policymakers talk about the importance of maintaining the health of their democracies. Maduro of the European Digital Media Observatory has proposed treating the platforms like what in Europe are called essential facilities, the European version of public utilities, and subjecting them to more regulation. Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Massachusetts Democrat, has outlined a similar idea in the U.S. It would be a huge shift. It's time to ask whether the American way of protecting free speech is actually keeping us free. Hannah Arendt finished her classic work on totalitarianism in the early 1950s after barely escaping Germany with her life. She was a Jewish intellectual who saw the Nazis rise to power by demonizing and blaming Jews and other groups with mockery and scorn. Arendt wrote that the ideal subject of fascist ideology was the person, quote, for whom the distinction between fact and fiction and the distinction between true and false no longer exist. It's worth noting that when Orwell wrote 1984, this is me now, that when Orwell wrote 1984, that his model was Joseph Stalin and the communist regime, that hate is love, war is peace, And there was another ministry, the Ministry of Truth, Lies or Truth, or something like that. The Stalin regime was known to literally change photographs to airbrush out opponents that either were in disfavor or had been killed.
Yes.
So that not only did they not exist any longer, but as far as the regime was concerned historically, they had never existed. So, free speech. Should there be a limit? Is there a reasonable limit? Where is the point you're doing the equivalent of yelling fire in a crowded theater, which has been adjudicated to not be protected by free speech that the government can prosecute for it?
Well, actually, I want to give you the opportunity to give your thoughts first on this, if you have any, because I feel like I may meander a bit.
And I never do that. Well, what is it specifically? I mean, I've been... I want to point out, as long as this article was to read, it is heavily excerpted.
Yes.
So that is the reason why I always suggest, if you have any questions or wonder about what the article in whole may have been, in any case, in any article, go to my website so you can link to the original article and go there and read it as it was. So what is the question you want to ask me if I have any thoughts on, which is probably the case?
I just was wondering if you had any thoughts that you desperately wanted to get out.
I'm torn. I mean, I think I'm torn as any progressive is torn, any thinking progressive. And just like with conservatives, not all of those people do both of those things. You know, it would be great if everybody believed in the truth as best they understand it, facts as best they know them, being honest as best they can. It would be nice if everybody felt that way all the time, but not everybody does. And that puts us in a world where, as the Europeans said, as I think it was Maduro that said, does democracy need to protect itself from anti-democrats? And somewhere in that process, are you throwing, as they say, the baby out with the bathwater, which, by the way, is actually a thing, which is where the expression came from.
Right. The idea specifically of, you know, Europe's restrictions on free speech, Europe's sort of absence of reverence for it, I think is a
well,
good
and, way. And I'm going to interrupt for a moment because I think it's important to point out Europe is a much older civilization, and they've had their share of tyrants, and they've had their share of tyrants within the last 100 years usurping democracies. We have not experienced that. So I think that that's where the discussion, you know, maybe we might be experiencing it now, and maybe it'll teach us some humility and some understanding, and maybe in some ways it'll make us a better citizen of the world when we try to be an example for other countries. You know, a little humility as well as having faced the abyss, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, I feel compelled to point out that Europe is a collection of civilizations rather than one unified civilization.
It's a collection of tribes. I think it's more or less a civilization.
Okay. Well, we're getting into the weeds a bit there, though.
Yes, we are.
I mean, I think in terms of, you know, the European approach to free speech, I think it could do us some good. You know, my general ideal notion of free speech is, you know, speech that is spoken with, you know, that challenges the government, but in a good faith attempt to improve the government, to improve society, to improve the lot in life of the people. You know, that's something that I think can be, you know, fairly, very enthusiastically defended. Of course, the problem arises when you have to figure out what good faith is and what is good faith and what isn't good faith.
Whose idea of good faith?
Yeah. And I keep bringing up this idea of good faith ever since I saw it in, like, Wikipedia's basic list of you know, rules. It's like their first rule: assume good faith. And I don't know why it has stuck with me so much, but it has. I've been using it more and more recently. It's, you know, it's kind of a reflection of the old saying, never attribute to malice what you can attribute to stupidity. You know, even if somebody does something wrong, it doesn't mean that they were trying to harm anybody. And right. while that may not, you know, absolve them of responsibility, while it may not get rid of the effects, it's at least something to consider.
Well, one thing I'll point out, we're running out of time, so I'm going to take kind of the last word on this. Whatever we decide to do with our First Amendment freedoms, it's important to understand exactly what that means. It's in the Constitution. It's the First Amendment. So unless we're planning on amending the Free Speech Amendment, whatever laws we pass, whatever practices we change are going to have to pass court muster because they will be challenged. Things like preventing anonymity, having to take responsibility for the contributions you make in speech or in money or in kind. Those kinds of things we can probably pass court muster with. But in terms of actually changing the kinds of speech you can do, that's going to be much tougher.
The WikiLeaks mention, I did a little bit of research, you know, while doing the show. There's only so much research I can do. I didn't find a whole lot of corroborated claims that any information in the DNC leaks were fabricated. You know, maybe you at home could do some of your own homework and research on that. But I just, you know, that's a claim I felt was important to sort of corroborate and validate. I would say
from contemporaneous and subsequent readings that in recent years, when there has been an information dump from WikiLeaks where it has been associated with the Russian intelligence establishment, a lot of it has been true and some of it has been strategically false.
With the mention in the article of the changes in the media landscape and media law, the public interest aspect required of broadcasters, for-profit broadcast has kind of let go of that, I think.
You know, well, as the article says, they always made lots of money. They just were working under a different set of rules. You know, just rewind the rules 40 years.
Right, and the Reagan administration walked that set of rules back. I think it's nonprofit public broadcasting like KPFT, which has kind of taken up that mantle.
There you
and
go.
That's why you should give us money.
You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
See you later, folks.
Right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together? And find the place that's safe and warm. It's not too late. We should be giving. Only with love can we climb. It's not too late.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, host of The Attitude, heard wicked early on KPFT 90.1 FM. I originate on a little community radio station, WNHN-FM in Concord, New Hampshire. But like our big brother, KPFT, this definition of community radio ties us together. Quote, it should be made clear that community radio is not about doing something for the community, but about the community doing something for itself. In other words, owning and controlling its own means of communication. Close quote. I love this definition from AMARC Africa. So, folks, if you care about your community, you can show it by caring for KPFT 90.1 FM. Thanks for making The Attitude with Arnie Arneson part of the KPFT political talk. We love sharing the heat and the light. Big and bright.